Not exhaustively, because you would get exhausted, but we're just going to pick out the main highlights of the book of Job. And today in part one, I want us to look at character and reputation. And then next week, I would like us to consider the greatness of God. So if you have your Bibles with you, please turn to the book of Job, which is roughly almost in the center of the Bible, the middle of the Bible, if you like, and we'll see what God has to say to us this morning. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions were also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. I don't know why the servants are mentioned with the donkeys there, but there we go, we won't go into that. He doesn't mention his mother-in-law with the donkeys there either, but there we go, moving along swiftly. And he was the greatest of all men of the East, and his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of the day, of each one day of each one of these days. And he would send and invite 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was also among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered and said to the Lord, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? Have you not blessed the work of his hands and his possessions have increased on the land? But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, for he will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now it happened on the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing the donkeys, and the donkeys were feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans attacked them and took them. They slew them and the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another came and said, "Fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands which made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people and they died, and I alone escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will return there. For the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin nor blame God. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came to them and to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." And Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give his life. However, put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sores and boils from head to foot. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself, And while he was sitting in the ashes, then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Then Job's three friends heard of his adversity and came upon him. They came each one from his own place: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They came and made an appointment together to sympathize with Job and comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes from a distance, they did not recognize him. They raised their voices and wept, and each one of them tore his robe. They threw dust over their heads towards the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, and no one was speaking to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. I must admit that out of choice, I don't usually read the book of Job. It may not surprise you, I suppose, because when we read it, it does seem rather heavy going and depressing, doesn't it? It's like Job was having a Monday morning, and time and time... Sorry, I'm not rolling up my sleeves to do the dishes. Time and time again, just everything seems to come upon Job. And I just want to pick out this Sunday and next Sunday just a handful of little handles, if you like, so we can grab onto the fact of how great God is, even in adversity. Because when we read through the book of Job, very often we think it's just a book about pain and suffering and anguish and turmoil. But I want us to consider this morning is the simple fact that actually the book of Job is perhaps one of the greatest love stories ever written. Sometimes we think of the Psalms or Song of Solomon, or I was going to say Gone with the Wind, but I've never really watched that. So I'm not really sure if that's romantic. But the book of Job isn't just about suffering and anguish. It's about a man and his God, and whatever is thrown at this man, he still loves God. So as far as I'm concerned, the book of Job is probably the best love story ever told. I want to ask you this morning, whatever comes your way, do you still love God, or do you have wobbly moments at times? I guess we all have wobbly moments at times. And as you look at the book of Job, there's drama, there's psychology, there's emotion, there's perseverance. We see little snippets of the nature of Satan and the character of God. How do we treat the book of Job? Is it for real? Can we really trust it, or is it just a poetic story to illustrate a point? My feeling is that it's true. The book of James, chapter 5, verse 11 says this: "You have heard of the endurance of Job and seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings." If the New Testament speaks about the book of Job and treats it as fact, then even though some of it may seem a little bit weird and weigh out the fact that in one day all this seems to happen and the same kind of phrase comes along, there is this sense of poetry and prose about the book of Job. I believe it's true, and we can learn a lot from it. It's not just some sort of mythological fairy story. We can see how Job illustrates that point. The other thing we can look at when we see the book of Job is this whole sense of the power of grief and turmoil over losing everything. We see how Job's character is displayed in this, and character isn't made in crisis. Sometimes we think a crisis will develop our character, but very often a character is exhibited in crisis. And what we see is the real Job coming out whenever the pressure is on him. And when the pressure is on you and I, very often that's when our real character comes out, isn't it? We can't actually hold how we really feel about God or our neighbors or our family, or sometimes it's church or our friend. When the pressure is on, that's when our character is actually exhibited. And that's why I find Job one of the most amazing books I've ever read in the whole of my life, in the whole sense that his character, when it's squashed and squashed and squashed, he still does not turn around and blame God for any of his sufferings. The book of Job is one of the oldest books in history, certainly in literature. We don't know exact date for when it was written, but it's one of the oldest books we have, and people have sort of speculated through the book of Job. Philosophers have looked through it. Some famous philosophers of the 18th century, the 19th century, and the 20th century have certainly gone through it, all because it's how we try and deal with problems in the world, how we try and deal with problems. And when we look through the book of Job, one of the sources of suffering that seems to be coming out of that is sin. Job's three friends continually say to him, you must have sinned to get in this predicament. And as we look through the book of Job, we can see sometimes the sources of suffering comes from sin. Sometimes it's our own sin and that, how that affects us. Sometimes it's other people's sin and how that affects us. Sometimes it's avoidable actions that bring on suffering. For instance, if I was to ignore my mechanic's plea and say your brakes need replacing, then maybe the car would crash and I would cause injury. So there are times when we have done things that we shouldn't do that are avoidable. And then there are things in life that are unavoidable, physical or natural, and we just don't know, do we? Things happen in life, we just don't have an answer sometimes, do we? Hello, you still there? Thank you, you're still awake with me. I don't have answers in life, and I tell you what, when I read the book of Job, there's a lot of stuff in there I struggle with. But one of the things I've learnt as I've worked my way through the book of Job is simply this. Like Job, it's okay to say I don't know. Not that I have a blank kind of faith and my faith isn't reasonable or based on solid foundations, but it's all right to get through life and say sometimes, I don't know why this is happening. I don't know why that has happened, but God is able. So it's okay at times to say, I just don't know. When we look through Job here, he seems to have lost an awful lot. He's lost his cattle, he's lost his children, and he's lost his health. All within a short space of time. It's like the job's done. I'm surprised nobody's made a film out of this, but maybe it's too depressing. I don't know. But we will see that it's not depressing as time goes on. And I would encourage you to get through the book of Job and plod your way through it. As we look at the basic essence of Job this morning, maybe that will encourage you to do that. I want us, first of all, to look at the responses that Job has to suffering. Chapter 2 and verse 9, his wife says to him, are you still holding on to your integrity? What a thing to say from somebody nearest and dearest to you. And yet sometimes when we're going through pain and suffering, very often it's the people who are closest to us that can say the worst things in life. It could be your partner, it could be somebody in your family, it could be a neighbor, it could be a close friend. And here from Job's wife, she says to him, why don't you just curse God and die? Why don't you just give up? All this has gone on. Do you think God's still really interested in you? Why don't you just give up on life? And many people go down that route without pushing forward and just seeing what God has in store. So that's the first response that Job gets from those nearest and dearest. Secondly, there's this friend of his called Eliphaz the Temanite, or I like to call him a termite because he's a bit of a bore. Oh, and chapter 5, verse 8, he says to, or the hint of this from chapter 5, verse 8 to Job is, you've got all this suffering because you've sinned. And he says this, go to God and lay your cause to him. That's what I would do. So Eliphaz has this spirituality about him that says, listen, Job, if you want some advice, get your life sorted out. You've obviously done something really wrong here. Go to God and get it sorted out. Has anybody ever said that to you, Tim? When you've got a problem, they said, what have you done wrong to God this time? I think we've all probably heard that one, haven't we, when we've got a problem in life and somebody says, have you done something wrong? Have you repented? Have you got right with the Lord? As we look at the book of Job, right in the very beginning here, we see that he's actually so concerned about sin that he's making sacrifices and prayers on behalf of his children just in case they've unintentionally cursed God. This guy is absolutely paranoid about keeping his relationship right with God, and yet a friend comes with him and says, have you done something wrong, Job? Job's life is like an open book. He's trying to keep himself right with God all the time. Within the New Testament, we have things like the gift of discernment. But very often in church life, what we end up with is the gift of observation. Ah, I see, something's wrong. Anybody can be like Job's friends. Go and lay your cause to him. That's what I would do. And there's a sense of arrogance about Eliphaz. Then there's another chap called Bildad the Shumite. I have this vision that perhaps he's bald. Bildad, I would call him the Shumite. And in chapter 8, verse 2, he says, or insinuates that Job's suffering because he sinned, but he won't admit that he sinned. He's hiding something. And he says this, how long will you be like this? Your words are like a blustering wind. Again, that's pretty depressing to hear all that kind of stuff from his wife, from his two friends. When all this has gone on, and all he needs really is somebody just to sit down with him and perhaps say, we don't understand. Let's just sit and work this out together. I look at the past when I'm involved with some things in the past, and I've given all these answers to various people because I've been a right thicker. I think we've probably all done that, haven't we? When we've been insensitive and ungracious and we've said to people, it's because you're sinning, Tim. That's why things are going wrong. What I would do is go and repent and get my life sorted out. You know, that's what we would do, isn't it? Just using you there, because usually I would use... Yes, well, usually I would use Tom, but, you know, he's probably getting a bit fed up of me using him. I won't use anybody else, but can you see the picture, this whole sense of actually, we've all been like Job's wife. Why are you still hanging on to that? Why don't you just get on and do something else? We've all been like these friends. And there's another chap called Zophar the Naamathite. It's interesting, the name Naamah means pretty beloved. It comes in Genesis, but as you come towards the book of Job, Naamah, or the Naamathites, have become a people in their own right and a tribe and a village. When we called our daughter Naamah, it wasn't because she comes from Naamah, as in a village, or that she's a Naamathite. It just means pretty beloved, so we kind of like that. Anyway, Zophar the Naamathite comes from this village called Beloved, or Naamathite. And he says this in chapters 11, 13, and 14. Job's sin deserves even more than what he's getting. Because you're such a sinful person, Job, you actually deserve far more than what you're getting. I think if I was Job, I would go out and get a shotgun and really make a sin. And he says this, if you devote your heart to God and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and do not allow evil to dwell in your tent, then maybe he will lift you up to his face without shame. What a dreadful thing that all these friends are doing, are saying, to have got this stuck in life, you must have done something wrong, or your family's done something wrong. Do you remember as Jesus walked around, different people came up to him and said, who sinned, this man or his mum or his dad? Things don't change. People are always wanting to point the finger of blame when something goes wrong, when sometimes we just don't know. How many of you looked on your family's and friends' lives sometimes and had an autopsy? Not that you've put them on a table and cut them open and dug them around, but this whole sense of what has gone wrong. And you've struggled. You've had sleepless nights and you thought, if only I hadn't have done that, if only they hadn't have done that, when really we just don't know at times, do we? And we have to leave it with the Lord. But Job's friends go on and on and on. And the book of Job is a bit like that. And then fifthly, there's a chap called Elihu the Buzzite. And I think of a buzzard, so I think he probably had a big nose, this chap, because he's a young man and he stood around listening to the conversation of Job's other three friends. And he doesn't really know Job, but he's this young, youthful, arrogant, unexperienced sort of person. And he says this in chapters 32 and chapter 33. God is using suffering to mold you and train you. That's the influence of this. He says, be silent and I will teach you wisdom. Answer me if you can. Prepare yourself. I'm just like you. I am taken from clay. And this young man who's inexperienced has no idea about Job and the righteousness of Job, has this whole sense of trying to identify with him when actually he knows nothing of him. And maybe you've had that in the past as well. People who said to you, I know exactly how you feel, but you know in your heart that really they haven't got a sausage. It's interesting that the whole issue of suffering and pain and how we respond to suffering and pain is all found in the book of Job. But Job is just such a wonderful love story of how Job continues to walk with God despite what is going on around him. The other interesting thing about Job is he doesn't know what went on in heaven. As God and Satan have this kind of wager, if you like, and you could almost imagine Satan, this is my sort of transliteration of it, he says, I bet Job will give in just because of his wealth. He loves you just because you've blessed him. Job doesn't really love and follow you for who you are, but what he can get out of you. And as you read through the book of Job, I think Satan is so frustrated over and over again when he realizes that actually Job loves God, not because of what God has given to Job, but for who God really is. And sometimes we have to sort of put ourselves back up into that position and ask ourselves afresh, why do we really love God? Do we love God because he's blessed us and given us all these things that we enjoy in life? Or do we love God for who he really is? It's interesting, the Hebrew scriptures, when it talks about Satan, it says the Satan, in the sense that Satan means accuser. That's what that name means. And the accuser came to God and said to God, I can't find anybody in the world because I've been roaming around who still wants to follow you. And that's when God says, have you tried Job? Why didn't you try and take away everything that he has? And you will see that he still wants to love and follow me. So God isn't being cruel to Job. He's proving to Satan that actually part of his creation will still follow him despite what goes on. So God allows for Job to have his family, his possessions, and his health to be taken away, but not his soul. Job loses everything in life apart from what he was born with, just the essence of himself. How do you respond when you seem to lose everything in life apart from the essence of what God has given you, just the breath itself? Let's have a little look at how Job responds to that. His character and his reputation. 1 verse 5, we see that he's aware of his relationship to God. He's made sacrifices, as we've said, for and on behalf of his children, in case they have sinned against God. This guy, Job, is just so aware that he doesn't want anything to become in the way of himself and God, but he's always doing things to make sure that doesn't happen. Secondly, when he hears the calamities of his children and his possessions on Job 1 verse 20, it says that he tore his robe and that he shaved his head. He went through the motions of real desperate grief. But it doesn't stop there, because it says that after he shaved his head, he fell on the ground and worshipped. You see, when Job loved God, he wasn't just going through the motions of loving him. He really did love him, and the proof of that is the fact that he worships God despite all this going on. Sometimes it's hard to worship God, isn't it? Sometimes it's hard to come through those doors on a Sunday morning because something's gone on during the week, and we feel like tearing our clothes, and, well, I shaved my head, but that's nothing to do with grief. That's just another a man thing, I guess. And it's hard to come through those... Stop laughing, you ladies. It's hard to come through those doors sometimes and worship God, isn't it? But somehow Job, within himself, within his character, and this is when character really comes out, is can you still worship God when you've got nothing left to worship him for? That is astonishing, which is why when you read the book of Job afresh, it is just so for our times, when we've got banks going under and jobless things and terrorism and everything else, that we can still love God despite everything that is going on around us. And I'll show you how we do that as we go on. So he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he says, the Lord gave, the Lord can take away. There's this whole sense that Job said, well, it's all God's anyway. You see, Job's possessions didn't possess him. There's this whole sense of, do we own our things or do they have an ownership about us? How much do we really hang on to the things that we've got in life? How are they important for us? Or can God freely take them away as he's given them to you? That's a huge test, isn't it? Especially for a Jew who's so rich in this situation here. The Lord gave, the Lord can take away. And we see in chapter 1, verse 22, it says this, in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. You ever gone off in a huff in your relationship with God? Sorry, you can be honest with yourself. I won't ask you to put your hand up. You ever been pushed to the limits sometimes? You think, God, I've really had enough now. Or is that just me? We go through that at times, don't we? But it says here that even Job went through all this. He did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. You see, right from the very start, Job's relationship with God was he was in it for who God was, not for what God gave him. Whether it's his family or his possessions. And we live in really uncertain times, and we have to evaluate our relationship with God and say, do I come to the Lord's table for who he is or for what I've got out of him? And I think Job's friends were probably the kind of people that they followed God for what they could get out of him. And they were more concerned about getting their own lives right just because God would bless them and prosper them. Fourthly, when Job loses his health, and his response to all this, it says, when his wife said, why don't you just curse God and die? Why are you holding on to your integrity? Chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, Job did not sin with his lips. Isn't it really easy to say something we shouldn't to a response that comes to us sometimes? I had the JWs on my door yesterday. And when they went, I was thinking, well, I could have said that a bit better. It's easy to do that, isn't it, if we're really honest, to react in a way. But Job, maybe Job's just a fictitious character who we should just kind of emulate. He can't be a real person. Nobody can be like that. But no, I think Job is a very real person, and we can be like that. Character is as much about who you are and not just what you say. And Job says, shall we not accept adversity as well as good from the Lord? There's a beautiful part of Job's praise as a response in chapter 19, verses 25. And Job says this, I know that my Redeemer lives and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see him myself and not another. Oh, how my heart yearns within me. I know that my Redeemer lives. How on earth can Job say those things when he's lost so much, when he's going through so much pain and grief and suffering, and he says, I know my Redeemer lives? And this word in the Hebrew for know is yada. It means to experience. You see, Job already had this sense of relationship with God, as I've already said, that he was in it for who God was, not what he could get out of God. And some of the stuff from the prosperity gospel of the past is all this kind of stuff of, you know, God will give you this, this, and this if you do this. When in reality, we don't deserve anything. But because of the nature and the character of God and who he is, he gives us so much. Job lives for God, not for his possessions or for his lifestyle. His possessions did not possess him. I guess he had a relationship with God that we can all learn from. Job's character and reputation. Hebrews 12 says this, talking about Jesus, and this is where we need to think about how we can cope with struggles and things. It says this, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despised the shame, sat down on the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. You see, Job's sort of living over here in the past somewhere, and we're kind of living over here post-New Testament kind of stuff, where we live in the light of what Jesus has done. See, Job didn't have this sense of, well, Jesus has come to sort out all your problems and things and to die for your sin and to deal with that. But we live in this whole sense of sometimes when pain and suffering comes along and things that we can't understand, we have to keep our eyes firmly focused on the cross. Because Jesus has borne the ultimate in pain and suffering. How do we kind of work this all out? How can we have that sense of being like Job, where we're in it for who God is and not for what we can get out of him? Somebody once said to me, look after your character and your reputation will look after itself. See, we don't come to church because we feel like it. We don't worship God because we feel like it. We come to church and we worship God because he's worthy, despite what we see around us. And I wanted to sort of have a little bit of a way of trying to illustrate that with you this morning, so you don't sort of forget what I've said. Now, here we go. All our pain and all our suffering and all things we don't understand have to be based on the death and the resurrection of Jesus. When we do that, there is this sense, like Job, we can find that place of worship. I know that my Redeemer lives. We have to go back to the cross. It's interesting that Job had no idea what was going on in heaven at the time, things that were going on about him. And he had no idea about Jesus. We live in the light of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. The fact that he's actually borne all our pains, all our sufferings, all our grief. He actually knows how we feel. Some people say, well, why didn't God do something about it? Well, actually, he came as a man. Whereas Job's friends just pretended to solve his problems and in arrogance pretended to be able to identify with him, we actually go to somebody who does identify with us, who came as a man, who experienced life's traumas and griefs, who was hungry and thirsty, who was nailed to the cross, experienced the fear and the pain of death, and rose again to prove all that he said and did. Now, isn't that worth worshipping? Hello, you still with me? For me, it kind of makes all my life and all my past hurt seem quite insignificant in the sense of what Jesus has done on behalf of me. to solve my temporary problems so I can spend eternity with him. Because what you're living through now is temporary. It may feel like eternity at times, because some problems in life don't seem to get solved, do they? You still with me? Am I just rambling to myself? Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to ramble here, I know. But there's this whole sense that because of the death and resurrection of Jesus, our temporary situations are solved so we can have an eternity with him. A happy ever after, if you like. Now, because of that, our prayer life kind of takes off. And we think, yes, I can talk to the Lord. And he hears my prayers and answers me. Interesting how when Job goes through suffering, he still maintains his prayer life and his worship life with God. And then as well as that, we have this sense of our devotional life with God. Can you all see that? Got some binoculars? And see how all these things are actually based on the death and resurrection of Jesus. There's this whole sense of, what's your quiet time like? That's a difficult one at times, isn't it? Especially when life is really difficult. But your character and everything about yourself, this will balance on here, is all based on how you are with the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And the moment you remove that from your life falls apart. It's as simple as that. You remove the death and resurrection, the reality of the death and resurrection. Job said, I know my Redeemer lives. And I want to ask you this morning, do you know that Jesus really lives? Or do you just come to church because that's what you do? You know. You've experienced, and that's what Job says to his friends. I have experienced that my Redeemer lives. And everything else seems to fail into insignificance with him. Remove Christ from your life and your life collapses. Now there is another way of doing this, and that's putting self on the bottom, saying I'm the most important thing in my life, and I will base everything else on that, but it just doesn't work. You have to have good foundations and put the cross back in your life. And I want to ask you this morning, put Jesus and his death and resurrection back in your life and build on that, and everything else will make sense. And even when it doesn't make sense, there's this sense of being able to cope with the fact that it doesn't make sense. Does that make sense? I'd say when he goes through the book of Job, some of it's really complicated, and it's really philosophical and deep, but it all comes to this sense of, at the end of the day, I don't know, but he does. And I trust him enough to let go of what I don't know and just get on and live in the light of that I accept God for who he is and not what I can get out of him. Because we live in a culture of what we can get out of people and what we can get out of each other. And unfortunately, in the United Kingdom, right across every church in the United Kingdom, the people go to church because it's what they can get out of church. That's sad, isn't it? Instead of we come because he is so worthy. He endured for us so that we can have a blessed forever. Job says, yet with my eyes, not somebody else's, not Bildad or anybody else, with my eyes I will see God. And I would encourage you to read through the book of Job, to plow through it. There's some wonderful poetry, there's all sorts in there. And next week we'll look at the greatness of God. But my heart this morning is like Job's cry, yet will I see God with my eyes. That this morning that you will see something of God afresh. And all the issues that you go through, which are so painful at times and so deep and so overwhelming, would all be put at the foot of the cross. And you suddenly realize, hey, Jesus loves me so much. And as I said, as we took part of the wine this morning, if you could read the small print in the Bible, it just says, he loves you. He loves you. He loves you. Where else are you going to go with that? Let's just bow our heads before the musicians lead us in a worship song. Father, this morning I just ask that we would see something of your goodness and your mercy to each one of our lives. That if we spend a little bit of time in the book of Job, we will see how our lives need to be totally based on you. Not on what we have or who we're connected to, but on you. And I pray this morning, Lord, for myself and others as well, that we would worship you for who you are and not what we can get from you. that we would worship you even when it's grief and pain and suffering that we're experiencing, like Job did, Lord. Teach us about his character, that no matter what pressures came upon him, he held fast to you, even when he didn't have the answers. Help us to have that kind of faith, that when we don't know, there's a sense of, yet will I see you, yet will I trust you, yet will I follow you. In Jesus' name I ask. Amen. If musicians can come and lead us in a final worship song.